Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Throughout Appalachia, grocery stores are disappearing.
There used to be little stores all in the communities, and now the big stores have pushed them out, you know, so all of your little mom and pop store, grocery stores that used to be around are now gone.
40 years ago, every holler had somebody with a little farm tractor, and they'd ride up and down the holler and till people's gardens for a dollar or two or a little gas or many times for nothing. What's happened now is that those tractors are all gone.
You know, a food desert is the retreat of grocery stores. And then it, of course, leaves the existing population that's there without access to nutritious, adequate, available, affordable food.
On today's show, we're talking about Appalachian food deserts and looking at some ways communities are resolving to take matters in their own hands.
You know I love that organic cooking. I always ask for more. And they call me Mr. Natural on down to the health food store. I only eat good sea salt. White sugar don't touch my lips. And my friends is always begging me to take them on macrobiotic trips.
Welcome. Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Food deserts, it's more than just an urban issue, and hey, we all gotta eat. An episode we first aired in July 2015 is still getting attention on social media and on the web. So this week, we're bringing you an encore presentation from the Inside Appalachia Archives about food deserts in Appalachia. Have you ever heard the term food desert? The term's legit. The USDA describes a food desert basically as parts of the country where people don't have access to fresh fruit, vegetables, and other healthful whole foods. It's a growing problem across Appalachia and the country. Bradley Wilson is a professor of geography at West Virginia University. He's been working on food access issues for the past 6 years. He says the term food desert can sometimes confuse people, and he doesn't even like to use it.
A desert is a natural formation, and there's nothing natural about food deserts. A food desert is the retreat of grocery stores from a particular area for particular reasons. So the way in which, then it, of course, leaves the existing population that's there without access to, specifically to nutritious, adequate, available, affordable food. And usually that entails specifically the loss of a grocery store. There's nothing natural about that. That's caused by competition between retailers. It's caused by a decline in income. Often in the population, depopulation, people leaving, demographic shifts, which are caused in large part by changes in the economy. So a food desert is simply a symptom of a broader economic change that's taking place. Again, I don't look at those as natural.
Wilson says none of these realities are really new, and that's especially true for folks in the coalfields.
If you look back historically, if you don't take the food desert contemporary concept as the starting point, but you look back historically about what has limited people's access to food in West Virginia, particularly in the southern coal fields, and you could go back to the story of scrip. I mean, if you're a miner and you're living in a company town, how do you access food? Well, you have to go to a company store. Well, what does the company store offer? Well, again, you don't necessarily have a ton of control over whether it's nutritious, you know, appropriate and affordable per se. And all of it's actually paid through your wages, essentially. So I think that the question of the food desert, for me, is somewhat problematic for the purposes of saying that it's not a natural thing that people don't have access to food for all of the reasons I've just described. But secondly, I think it's problematic because it often suggests that that problem of access is something new. It is an old problem. This is something that's been around for a long time. Hunger is not new. Mm-hmm. The fact that it's not been resolved today is perhaps staggering to the imagination, given the amount of food that we produce in the United States.
That's Bradley Wilson, a geography professor at West Virginia University. We'll hear more from Wilson a little later in the show as we talk more about food deserts. And then we'll have a treat at the end of the show with Appetite Appalachia. It's our regular feature on restaurants that serve local foods and chefs who are cooking up food with Appalachian roots. After all, going out to eat's a special treat, one we love to share with you. But first, we'll start with a story of struggle and hope in West Virginia. About 40 counties in the state endure some sort of limited food access, and the number is growing as more and more true grocery stores close their doors. The Piggly Wiggly in Clay County is one that recently closed. Roxy Todd talked with residents there to ask how this has affected them. Nikita McLaughlin was making a few purchases at the local Dollar General, a store that has in many ways come to replace local grocery stores.
Well, it's a 12-mile trip into Clay from where I live from Wallback. So I'm either having to go to Clendenin, or I have to drive to Flatwoods or Gasaway. So you're looking at around 20 miles to go somewhere else. But I mean, there's lots of people that live in this town that really are suffering because of there not being a grocery store here, just for general public. So it's inconvenience. It's really been an inconvenience, even for somebody like me who can have the ability to drive. There are a lot of people affected a lot worse than I am. That's for definite sure. Well, I mean, I have a neighbor lady who's a widow who doesn't drive. So, I mean, that was her main stop is the Piggly Wiggly here that she'd done in Clay. Now she has to get somebody to take her to the grocery store 20 or 30 miles away to go. I mean, I think, you know, as well as the Family Dollar and the Dollar Store has done in supplying basics, bread and milk, it can't get you your meat. It can't get you your fresh vegetables that people really need. I mean, you know, and it's really been an inconvenience for a lot of people. That's the sad thing.
That was Nikita McLaughlin, who lives in Wallback, West Virginia. Her story is not unique. What she's noticing in her community since they lost their grocery store is occurring in small towns throughout Appalachia. But when the grocery store in one West Virginia town closed in Greenbrier County, the community worked to find local resources with hopes of becoming self-sufficient. Last November, the IGA in Alderson shut its doors for good.
They just closed her down. And then, so we were thought you had to go to Lewisburg or to Hinton or somewhere else to get groceries.
Resident Rick Bostick says he was driving 25 miles to find fresh produce. He missed that IGA. It was the community's only grocery store.
You know, you'd run over and get what you needed, and, you know, like meat and grocery items and produce, and now, you know, they got it here, so it's really helpful.
After it closed, all the community had was basically a Dollar General, some gas stations, and a tiny co-op in the corner of a local gift shop that sold things like beans, seeds, and nuts. That co-op was part of the Alderson Community Food Hub. It's a nonprofit that runs a community garden and a farmer's market. Organizers had been thinking of expanding the co-op, but they didn't expect that to happen for a while.
When the grocery store closed, it started feeling more like an imperative.
Anna Osborne has been involved with the hub for about 4 years now.
Because the fact is that for a lot of people in this town, traveling to Lewisburg to get their groceries is not only a hardship, in some cases it's just not even an option. So if we wanted people in our town to have access to fresh fruits, vegetables, meats and cheeses, we felt like it was our turn to step up and try to make it happen.
The Wolf Creek Gallery gift shop owner agreed to move her gallery to make room for the new expanded co-op. The hub named the new store the Green Grocer. They bought refrigerators and wire shelving and stocked the shelves with a $25,000 grant from the One Foundation last year. Now you'll find folks sitting at one of the tables by the windows eating lunch from the cafe while a steady flow of traffic strolls by shelves of oranges, bananas, and apples. Osborne says the project's meant to provide healthy food to consumers and to provide a market for local farmers.
Nothing against the grocery store, but most of the produce that was carried there was from out of state or not local. And our mission has always been to support the local economy and local farmers. And so the community market seemed like an opportunity to do that.
They're a busy bunch of farmers.
This is store manager Ann Knotts.
But they keep us, you know, as soon as the season starts, we've had strawberries out the ears, but we've been selling them out the ears. And, oh, gosh, what else is there? Lettuce, beets, snow peas. Now other kinds of berries are starting to come in. Pretty soon it'll be green beans and tomatoes and corn.
Knott says the project is doing well financially. It got a second $30,000 grant from the One Foundation this year. But its largest chunk of cash came from donors to an Indiegogo campaign. Knott says folks from across the world sent a total of $31,000 to help the cause. The co-op helps to keep its costs down by having volunteers on staff. Helping to run the register in the store today is volunteer Mary Moody. She moved to Monroe County in the 70s as part of the Back to the Land movement.
Well, I feel like I have been very, very fortunate in life, and it's important to give back. I'm semi-retired. I have the time. I think this is a very important project in our community that we have a grocery store. And this one is especially special, if you will, because of the local produce and meats and things that we buy.
Volunteers also help with other odd jobs like cleaning. It helps to keep prices for this small nonprofit co-op low. Rick Bostick, the guy who used to drive to Lewisburg for groceries, says he's glad the store's here. He stopped in on the first day the Green Grocer was carrying fresh meat.
Well, they have signs of fresh meat, and there's nowhere here in town to get any meat, you know, except for like frozen stuff at the dollar store, Dollar General. So, but they didn't have what I wanted.
So what were you looking for here?
I was looking for a pork roast, actually. They got some good meat in there, but they just didn't have the pork roast. I wanted the pork roast.
Still, Bostick is happy to be able to find fresh produce, and manager Ann Knott says the co-op is getting to know the needs of the community.
So we're not going to please everybody, and they may have had pork roast, and we've already sold out of them. I don't know. We've got a very limited amount of space. We don't have a huge cold storage butcher shop area where we can keep meats and bring it out and keep replenishing. They cut it at night when they're also smoking meats for the cafe. So it's going to be a challenge being able to keep things stocked and not run out and just keep everybody happy.
Folks can also leave suggestions or feedback in the suggestion box, but so far Knott says business is good.
We see an increase all the time. We're trying to get a lot more visibility. We have a lot of people say, well, we don't know you're here because we don't have enough signage out front. So we're working on that. And word of mouth has just been tremendous, too. So, I mean, as you can see, it's pretty steady. And sometimes we're swamped, and that's a good thing, too.
Organizers of the project hope it can serve as an example to other communities that are losing grocery stores, sometimes because the population is falling, and sometimes because competition from chain stores that don't stock much fresh food.
There certainly is a need for greater access to fresh food in communities like Alderson all over the country.
That's Kevin Johnson, president of the board of directors of the Alderson Community Food Hub. He says folks in the community have been supportive of the project because losing the grocery store was such a big loss to the area.
Food is such a fundamental part of what people's daily lives that it's almost like a service. So like when a small town loses its hardware store, it's not you're losing one of three hardware stores and there's another place to shop. You're losing your one hardware store, and people register that as their town's identity is changing.
Organizers are hoping the Green Grocer Project will continue to grow and reach more members of the community. Currently, the group distributes food to the senior center to help out people who don't drive, and they've just gotten donations to get a system to keep food cold while it's on the road. So some communities are looking to deal with their lack of grocery stores by taking the situation in their own hands. One of the organizations that helped make the new Alderson Grocery Co-op possible is called Grow Appalachia. The program works to help people grow their own food by providing grants, farm training seminars, and other farming resources. Grow Appalachia is based out of Berea College in Kentucky. Here's the program's director, David Cook.
Much of the negative wellness indicators in Central Appalachia are directly tied to nutrition issues. So much of the region is classified by USDA as a food desert. There are dozens of food deserts in rural areas, and The irony is that we live in the most diverse temperate ecosystem on the planet, and people are hungry because they don't have food that's grown locally. Hundreds of thousands of families in central Appalachia, they don't have access to food, and if they did, they couldn't afford to buy fresh fruits and vegetables. So our goal was to put food security right in the backyards of thousands of families where they could just walk out and work their own gardens and grow their own food, and that's what we've done.
Cook says he and the other staff at Grow Appalachia soon realized that there are thousands of people in Appalachia who want to grow their own gardens.
We don't have to talk anybody into being a part of this program. What we found is that there is enormous desire on the part of families to have that kind of agency and control in their lives, and all they've lacked is the knowledge of how to do it, as well as the capacity to actually get in the gardens and do the work. 40 years ago, every holler had somebody with a little farm tractor, and they'd ride up and down the holler and till people's gardens for a dollar or two or a little gas or many times for nothing. What's happened now is that those tractors are all gone. People haven't replaced the tractor. So one huge impediment to folks growing their own food is that there's no way to get them tilled. Each of our sites buys a small but really high-quality walk-behind tractor, and we till literally thousands of gardens every year, which is a big roadblock to folks being able to do that. We also have a series of classes that we offer at each site. How do you plan a garden? How do you plant a garden? How do you maintain a garden? How do you cook in hard, healthy ways, which is a skill that's been lost by so many people? And also, how do you preserve food? How do you dehydrate it, freeze it, can it in safe ways?
So here's the Grow Appalachia program in numbers. It grew more than 636,000 pounds of food last year. They're in five Appalachian states, including Kentucky, Virginia, West Virginia, Tennessee, and Ohio. They help run 110 community gardens. One of the first gardens they helped create is the Laurel County African American Heritage Center Grow Appalachia program in Kentucky. Wayne Riley grew up here, and he now manages this garden and helps people in his community grow their own food to eat and to sell.
I think that a lot of people have a misconception of people in Appalachia that people are obese and it's because they overeat. And I think that part of it is that they are eating unhealthy food. We're so quick to run to the fast food restaurants and grab food rather than cook healthy food. And I think that some of the people have forgotten how to cook and how to grow healthy food. So I think it's very important that we get back to that.
Riley does notice that lots of people in his area of eastern Kentucky don't have access to nearby grocery stores.
Well, I think that's part of the problem, you know, because, I mean, you know, there used to be little stores all in the communities, and now the big stores have pushed them out, you know, so all of your little mom and pop store, grocery stores that used to be around are now gone, you know. I mean, we just lost really one of ours about 2 months ago in East Bernstead that has been there for as long as I can remember, you know. But they can't compete with the big stores, and so they get pushed out, and people don't have a good source for food sometimes.
Riley says he thinks there are a lot of people who want to eat healthier, but they don't feel like they can afford fresh or organic food.
I think there's more of the younger generation that really they look at eating healthy, but then they go to Kroger's and Walmart and they go to the organic section, and you know, and the food is just so expensive to where they not, you know, they can't afford it. So, you know, then they have to walk past it and go to a different area. But when you can show them how they can grow organically just as cheap as you can conventionally, you know, then they're all enthused about it and they're ready to go with it, you know.
Holly Korb is an AmeriCorps Vista with Grow Appalachia. She works to give folks like Wayne Riley the resources to help other people to grow gardens, like the one in Laurel County. She loves every minute of it.
It really does help to bring people together, you know, not, of course, not just for eating food, which everybody loves to do, but just, you know, really getting out here and working these gardens and working these lands and just, you know, being a part of something that's going to impact so many people, you know. I don't see how anyone wouldn't be on board with something like that.
Grow Appalachia helps people grow their own food in their own backyards and at 110 community gardens throughout Appalachia. More information is on our website at wvpublic.org. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. When we come back, we're going to talk more about people who are trying to help change the food landscape in Appalachia and help bring food to more low-income families.
I'm going to plant myself in my own garden. Dig down deep. Water often. Send strong roots down. Lift long.
At the beginning of the show, we heard from Bradley Wilson, a researcher from West Virginia University who studies food deserts in the state, even though he hates that term. He and his colleagues are working to understand the problem of hunger and access to food in Appalachia. They're working to holistically understand food insecurity in West Virginia with a program they call West Virginia Food Link. As Glynis Board reports, the program is trying to connect people to food resources that already exist throughout the Mountain State.
According to data from the U.S. Census Bureau, about 15% of all West Virginians, or about 1 in 7, is food insecure, which means they have a hard time at some point throughout the year putting food on the table for lack of money, access, or resources in general. But what does that really mean? How many people in West Virginia are hungry right now?
The story of West Virginia is all of these statistics, like about obesity or health problems or poverty, or there's statistics about depression, and there's, you know, it's the saddest place to live. I mean, like, this is something that I read maybe like 3 or 4 months ago. It's the saddest place to live. And it's like, well, you know, the people of West Virginia are incredibly creative, and they're finding ways of making do with a situation that they themselves did not create.
That's Bradley Wilson, a professor of geography at West Virginia University. Wilson has been studying food and hunger issues, and importantly, thinking about why and how we are in our present situations.
These economic changes that have taken place over the past, you know, 3-4 decades in West Virginia, the decline of manufacturing, you know, the decline of coal, and the post-industrial economy here with large numbers of people working in the service sector making minimum wage, those are the cards that people have been dealt, and they've been trying to figure out a way to make that work. So there's a certain creativity that people bring that is not the story of West Virginia that is often told.
Wilson is the director of an ongoing project at the university called West Virginia Food Link. When the project launched, Wilson discovered there were more than 650 agencies working to combat hunger across the state.
There's a massive network of emergency food assistance agencies and anti-hunger agencies working across the state of West Virginia, serving between 200 and 300,000 people a month.
Food pantries, soup kitchens, charities, nonprofits, free school meal programs. Wilson and his team call it the Emergency Food Network. And in the West Virginia Food Link labs, they've been gathering a lot of data that's generated to try to grasp the extent of the network. Wilson and his team created a website to help spread information about the work that's being done. They're posting information and a lot of maps, like a food desert map of West Virginia they made for Inside Appalachia. But we live in a very fluid and changing world. We almost need real-time maps to keep up with the morphing food landscapes.
This emergency food network is itself extremely vulnerable, and we're finding a lot of pantries just closing shop, even since we started this project.
Joshua Lonis is a PhD student in the Department of Geography at WVU and the Associate Director of Food Link. His focus these days is really to determine how exactly people are accessing their food, whether it's driving to a food pantry or hunting, gardening. FoodLink researchers are definitely observing a major trend in the rise in popularity of alternative food networks like farmers markets and CSAs. But farmers markets today still only feed about 1% of West Virginia's entire population.
We are not anti-farmers market. We like want farmers markets. But how do you build both? How can we utilize the strengths of both? And I think that's where a lot of the interesting and innovative stuff's happening.
Food pantries with hydroponics operations, gardeners' consignment shops, mobile markets, food pantries hosting farmers markets or growing their own food. These are some of the innovations we're beginning to see in West Virginia. But Wilson says we need to see a lot more.
The way to scale up farmers markets, the way to scale up the alt food networks, inevitably is going to have to be in West Virginia, you know, addressing the question of how to incorporate and invite low-income households and low-income families to participate.
To that end, Wilson and Lonis at West Virginia Food Link are collaborating with many organizations to help connect efforts. The state's food banks, West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, the Benedum Foundation, and the Sisters of St. Joseph, just to name a few. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
Special thanks to West Virginia Food Link for mapping West Virginia's food deserts for us here on Inside Appalachia. You can take a look at it on our website at wvpublic.org. It's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the names of Appalachian places. Can you guess the town in Appalachia that got its name because hunters would store their meats in a cabin there? Is it Porky, Pennsylvania, Chicken Gizzard Ridge, Kentucky, or Meat Camp, North Carolina? We'll have the answer after the break. This is Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So, did you guess which town got its name because of the hunters that would store their meat there on long trips? If you guessed Meat Camp, North Carolina, you're right. We talked to Eric Plagg with the Watauga County Historical Society to tell us more about how Meat Camp got its name.
But what about the name Meat Camp? Well, that allegedly comes from a cabin that folks known as long hunters kept nearby, apparently as early as the 1760s, where they stored meat and hides during lengthy hunting trips. In time, that cabin became what Arthur calls a primitive packing house, where hunters likely dressed and cured their kills before heading out to continue hunting. Over time, the location became more famous for its nearby creek, Meat Camp Creek, which sported a substantially improved mill by 1840, including a carding machine. The meat storage business grew too, so that by the time of the Civil War, farmers frequently drove their livestock to Meat Camp to be sold or slaughtered before being sent to market. Other stories, including an account of Gilbert Norris in the Watauga Democrat in 1891, indicate a variation on this theme. Norris reported that the name came from hunters whose meat burned up in that cabin while they were hunting in the area.
If you have another story about Meat Camp or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name, and we might explore it inside Appalachia. Now, we go over to Virginia, where we find Dr. Susan Clark, the program director of the Appalachian Food Shed Project and part of Virginia's Food Desert Task Force, among other things, at Virginia Tech. She recently took part in a study called Food Deserts in Virginia, Recommendations from the Food Desert Task Force. The study focused on determining the current status of food deserts in the Commonwealth of Virginia. We checked in with Clark to help break down the food desert. The USDA describes a food desert, and I'm summarizing, basically as parts of the country where people don't have access to fresh fruit, vegetables, and other healthful whole foods. What are some of the unique challenges for finding fresh produce in Appalachia?
I think there's an issue around access with regard to public or private transportation. I also think that there is limited numbers of large grocery stores that source from local vendors in the community. I think there's also some concerns around or challenges around just the cost or the perceived cost of more healthy, fresh fruits and vegetable food items for folks living in Appalachia. The distance that an individual within a community might have to travel to a farmer's market, if they even have one, presents challenges if they have limited transportation sources.
And some folks might say, oh, well, we have plenty of non-perishable food available in our community and in the cupboard, getting back to food deserts a little bit. I know fresh fruits and veggies are the recommended best things to eat, but at least I have food in the cupboard. As a nutritionist, can you tell us what happens to the body without these fresh foods?
Well, I think foremost, some of those foods that are highly processed, high in fat and high in sugar and salt, are what I call empty calories. They don't have the essential nutrients, both vitamins and minerals, that our bodies need. And as a result of that, can present problems with diet-related chronic diseases, such as diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, and related also to that would be obesity issues. So I think it's flipping it the other way and talking about the benefits of a diet higher in fruits and vegetables, which corresponds to the government's My Plate recommendations, where half of your plate basically is filled with fruits and vegetables, speaks volumes about providing essential nutrients, not to mention dietary fiber in the diet. And those have been associated with a decreased risk of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, hypertension, and obesity. We know that diets higher in fruits and vegetables, there's some empirical data now coming out that showcase that BMIs, body mass index, are lower, as well as blood pressure decreases, which helps mitigate hypertension issues. So there are a lot of benefits to a diet higher in fruits and vegetables for overall health and well-being.
And all the more reason why I think it's important for us to have this discussion about food deserts, folks to realize and start asking questions, well, where do I get my fresh fruits and vegetables? Because I think in these communities, a lot of times, they might not realize that, you know, the fresh food, even if they wanted it as an option, really isn't an option. So it seems like a lot of challenges in healthy choices for individuals to make, but then also accessibility in talking about food deserts. So what can be done about it? What are some of the solutions?
Well, I think that's the exciting opportunity that communities are coming together to find solutions, and they're very creative solutions to increase access to farmers markets. Those that can't get to the farmers market, we have examples of mobile farmer markets coming to them in their communities. We have that with Leap for Local Foods, has a mobile food market in Roanoke, and we have some through Southwest Virginia Feeding America has a mobile market that's going into very far Southwest Virginia with fruits and vegetables being distributed right to the locality. So those are some creative opportunities. Some of the groceries in some of these rural regions are also making partnerships with farmers and allowing the farmer to sell some of their produce within their grocery store. Some of the corner stores are also now beginning to introduce more fresh local produce into their facilities. And another thing, you know, to look at are there's some creative programming around home gardening and community gardens in some of these areas, so that then again increases the access. In food pantries are even starting to have land where they're actually growing their own food and having a food pantry garden so that they can distribute fresh produce to their participants. So I think there are a lot of different opportunities that we're seeing with some of the work with the Appalachia Food Shed Project that showcases an incredible amount of creativity to getting local fresh produce to individuals that have limited access to it.
Dr. Susan Clark is the program director of the Appalachian Food Shed Project and part of Virginia's Food Desert Task Force, among, like we said earlier, many other things at Virginia Tech. Dr. Clark, thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for the invitation.
Everything I am. Everything I am. everything I'll be.
The number of women who run farms is on the rise. According to the United States Department of Agriculture, women are the most rapidly growing segment of the farming population, accounting for more than 30% of all farmers. Today, more than 1 million women are working on farms, a number that has more than doubled since 1982. And they're raising $13 billion worth of produce each year. One of these women works on her farm in Gordonsville, Virginia. She's written a how-to book that she hopes will inspire more women to take up agriculture. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Beth Voorhees spoke with her.
Your book is called The Woman-Powered Farm, a manual for a self-sufficient lifestyle from homestead to field. Now, I'm probably the worst person to do an interview about farming. I can barely keep my houseplants alive. Or maybe that makes me the best person to do an interview about farming. I don't know. But why did you want to write this book?
Well, I started seriously farming about 9 or 10 years ago, and I really learned by trial and error. And part of writing this book was to provide the sort of book that would have been useful for me when I first started out. Of course, I did a lot of research and checked out a lot of books, bought a lot of books, and, of course, talked to lots of people, went to workshops. But I thought this book, as I kept on farming and people would come to me and, you know, ask me about what I did and how I did it, I realized, you know, that as I recommended books, there wasn't one that necessarily had some of this how-to information that is oftentimes the biggest stumbling block for new farmers or women getting started in farming in terms of doing these tasks that have been traditionally considered men's tasks, you know, like using a chainsaw or driving a tractor, those sorts of tasks, which seem intimidating. There wasn't really any information just for women out there. So that was one of the motivations for writing this book from a woman's perspective about farm chores that women need to do if they're running their own farm, but have traditionally been considered men's work.
And this is really a how-to book. It's loaded with pictures about how to do certain tasks. Tell us about these photos and where they came from.
Yeah, you know, and the step-by-step photos, for me, I'm a very visual learner. And luckily, my husband loves to take photographs. So all of the photos, the majority of them, are taken by my husband, Michael, and which it was a rather comic situation as he followed me around the farm trying to catch me doing farm tasks without me looking too grubby and exhausted. But all of the pictures are, you know, real women. Most of them are me. Some of them are other women farmers or neighbors doing these tasks and with step-by-step photos and captions explaining what's going on. The other very useful thing is the section on tools, which talks a little bit about the tools that are available for women that make jobs and chores a little bit easier for a woman's body. Since women are built differently from men and we don't have the upper body strength, there are tools that can help compensate for that. And so there's a great section on tools that I think is very helpful as well.
Okay, so for those of us who don't have green thumbs, but we'd like to get started in farming, what's the best way to get started?
Well, the best way to get started, I mean, really, you've got to jump on in there. But that said, it is a really great idea to make a plan. It's easy to get very excited. In the chapter on gardening, I mentioned this. You start getting these seed catalogs, you know, in the middle of winter when everything's gray and you're so ready to see flowers and vegetables, and it's a little, it can be a little intoxicating. So you need to be careful when you're starting out not to go overboard. Try to just grow the things that you know you're going to eat at first, because there's going to be a lot to take care of. when you first get started and you plant a few things, they seem really small and it's going to be easy, but then a couple months go by and you've got a jungle of on your hands, and it's a jungle full of bugs and weeds as well. So you're going to be busier than you think you are. So start off planting fewer things that you can take really good care of. It's easy to put in a lot of different things and then become overwhelmed and just decide, oh, I can't do this. So be particular. Choose carefully. Choose things that are right for your area. There are many things that I would love to grow, like artichokes, but they don't do well here. This isn't a Mediterranean climate, so I don't grow artichokes because I don't want to set myself up for failure. So give yourself a chance to succeed. Start off small. And, you know, maybe just do one raised bed or container gardening, something that you know you can get to after work if you're working full-time, that you'll have time to water and look after and care for. And then something that when it does come to fruition, you'll want to eat, that you'll want to harvest, like tomatoes. Unless you really love zucchini, I wouldn't grow it because you're going to have 8 million zucchini from one plant, and you're probably not going to eat all of that, and it takes up a lot of space. So grow things that you want to eat and start small.
That's very good advice. That almost sounds doable to someone like me.
I think it is, and I think it's a great way to start. And once you get that success, you know, you'll be able to branch out. And I try a lot of new things every year now, and some of them are great and some of them aren't. But because it's my full-time job, I kind of have that luxury where I can, you know, can do that. But when you've got other things going on, you need to, you know, not overwhelm yourself, or it's not going to be fun, and there should be an element of delight in having your own garden.
And you have some advice about keeping pigs. You've written a passage that touched me very much. Would you read the passage about pigs?
Yes. Okay. The biggest problem with pigs is that you fall in love with them. And if you have children, they will fall in love too. But a pig can grow to 500 pounds in a year and will be up to 700 pounds or more before you know it. When this happens, the meat is no longer useful and you're stuck feeding the equivalent of an army unit or wasting the animal's meat. So before you get a pig, steel yourself to the idea that it will be a summer romance only.
I was recently talking with a young woman named Heather Fry. She lives in Shamrock, West Virginia. That's a small town in Logan County. She's a Vista AmeriCorps volunteer in charge of the community garden there. And she told us recently that of all the citizens that work in the garden, it's the children who are the most enthusiastic about it. What advice do you have for growing children that will grow food?
I love that question. Yes, I'm so excited about how these local community farms and school gardens have sprung up and are just flourishing. I think the time was right, and it's such a wonderful, wonderful endeavor. And for the most part, it is women such as Heather that are kind of organizing and coordinating these gardens. And the children, it is fabulous. In fact, my sister has a lot to say about this. She's also a farmer. She's out in California. And I have several women farmers in this area that actually homeschool, and it's now, for them, they call it farm schooling. But getting back to your question about raising children that will raise food, that's how you do it. I mean, you introduce them to a garden, and they take off with it. Nature is the biggest playground for kids.
Audrey Levitino, thank you so very much.
Well, thank you very much, Beth. It's been a pleasure.
All but night I take out my strong box that I keep under lock and key, and I take it off to my closet where nobody else can see. I open that door so slowly, take a peek up north and south, then I pull out a Hostess Twinkie and I pop it in my mouth. Yeah, in the daytime I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. But at night, I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me. Well, at lunchtime, you can always find me at the Whole Earth Vitamin Bar, just sucking on my plain white yogurt,
from a hand-thrown pottery
Today
jar.
We've been talking about food deserts and looking at ways people are working really hard to help make fresh food available to more people in Appalachia. So we wanted to finish with something delightfully delicious, a story about a restaurant in Shepherdstown that's cooking up something fresh for our plates. So here's another installment of a new segment here on Inside Appalachia, which features restaurants and recipes with Appalachian roots.
Cornbread and butter beans and you across the table, eating beans and making love as long as I am able. Oh, and corn and cotton too.
Shepherdstown is a little place with a lot of history. Harper's Ferry and the Antietam Battlefield are literally down the road. The tiny downtown has Civil War-era brick buildings filled with mom-and-pop restaurants and shops. And there's a big demand for local organic foods. Liz McCormick with West Virginia Public Broadcasting visited a local favorite, a restaurant called Mellow Moods.
Have a good day, y'all.
When you walk into Mellow Moods, you might notice the hardwood floor, dark and even crooked and uneven in some places. There are chalkboards featuring food jokes, local artists have work hanging on the walls, and you can sit at a table or on a couch. The smells of frying eggs, fresh, warm bread, vegetables, blended fruits, and different cheeses waft through the air, mixing together. It's around brunch time.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you're cooking?
I'm doing an egg burrito. So it's two fried eggs, peppers, onions, fresh salsa, house-made guacamole on a whole organic whole wheat tortilla.
That's Mike Davis, and he's the regular cook in the mornings.
My favorite drink, smoothie-wise, would have to be the Kauai Sunrise.
By the register, Jesse Wilt is making smoothies and juices.
Here we go, and I'm going to try this. Good. No matter how long I've been making smoothies and juices, I still try to taste things because our produce does change all the time. We have different kinds of lemons, different kind of apples, different kind of kale. So you always want to make sure that you still taste test stuff. You can try that.
Oh, wow. That's really good.
The juice I tried was called Morning Dew.
So the Morning Dew is fresh mint. It's cucumber. It's lemon and agave, so it's really refreshing, and it kind of gives you all the minerals and the nutrients that you're kind of sweating out. Kind of instantly gives you that refreshing boost that you need.
We do all of our baking.
That's Phil Mastroangelo. He's the owner and founder of Mellow Moods, which he opened in 2007. He grew up just outside of Shepherdstown on the Maryland side of the Potomac River. Mastroangelo says he wanted to bring real organic foods to people in a society stuffed to the gills with processed foods.
To get whole foods to people, it started as nothing but vegetarian, because that is the easiest whole food. Fruits and vegetables. They are by far the simplest whole foods just to slice up and start eating.
But eventually he began offering things like organic chicken and wild salmon.
I didn't really want to jump in where everybody else was doing, and everyone else's menus have 90% meat, 10% vegetarian. I wanted to do 90% vegetarian, 10% meat. And it took off.
In summer, Mastroangelo gets most of his ingredients from local farmers, like Jimmy Foltz. I found Foltz at the local farmer's market, standing in front of a table full of potted herbs. He's known Mastroangelo for years.
I used to go over there and get some juices when he first opened up just as a juice shop. And as he built his business, my business kept building. And then I was like, why don't I grow some veggies for you, man? And he's like, yeah, do it. So we started about 3 years ago with me starting to grow more and more stuff vegetable-wise. But I've done everything organically since I've ever started, and I wanted to only do organic into an organic restaurant, and he is.
Owner Phil Mastroangelo says the restaurant gets food from other nearby farms, too.
I try to utilize as many as possible, mainly because I want as many local people to get my money as possible.
That's how the Red Rice and Hemp Burger came to be, to support a local business.
The Red Rice and Hemp Burger started with a friend's shop that was opening up, a hemp clothing store, and we wanted to do a special for them to help promote them, and just fell in love with it. And we make our own barbecue sauce, and we grill onions off. We have this amazing ciabatta bread, and the Red Rice and Hemp Burger was our first vegetarian burger.
The burger is a customer favorite, but so are other dishes.
Lox Sammy. Hands down, Lox Sammy.
This is Brian Albert. He says he comes into Mellow Moods four or five times a week.
It's wild salmon, wild smoked salmon, and it's really, really good. It's a great breakfast sandwich. Probably the best breakfast sandwich I've ever had.
We've been coming in here for 3 years.
Brahm is another regular. His brunch date has just finished her egg sandwich.
I always get it. I love it.
Now, we have a lot of confidence in Phil, the owner, and you've been talking to him a little bit, but he's all about fresh and good ingredients and creativity and health and Mother Nature, so it's a pretty comfortable place to come in and eat. It really is.
Other customers say every time they come in, they have the egg burrito, maple quinoa, or vegan nachos. But Mastrangelo says one of his favorite dishes is a very Appalachian one, his ramp special once a year when they're in season.
We do all kinds of stuff with ramps. Ramp and potatoes is one of my favorites, but I love ramps. They are the first food that, highly nutritious food that pops through in the spring.
It changes from month to month, but the menu always has a taste of the season and the region. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick in Shepherdstown.
The chefs at Mellow Mood sent us recipes for their red rice and hemp burger, sweet and sour basil smoothie, and a potato ramp soup. You can find those as well as photos and more information from all of these stories you heard today on our website at wvpublic.org.
Corn, bread, and butter, beans, and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able. Oh, and corn and cotton too, and when the day is over, ride a mule, a crazy fool, and love getting all over.
That music you hear is our Appetite Appalachia theme music, Corn, Bread, and Butter Beans by the Carolina Sunshine Trio. We also heard from Larry Gross with Junk Food Junkie. Other music was provided by Andy Agnew Jr., Jake Sheps, and the Glenville State Bluegrass Band. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our intern is Jade Arthur Holtz. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Ride a mule, a crazy fool, and love getting all over.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Oh, and corn and cotton too, and when the day is over, ride a mule, a crazy fool, and love getting all over.
Goodbye, don't you cry, I'm going to Louisiana. Buy a dog and a big fat hog and marry Susanna. Sing song, ding dong, gonna take a trip to China. Corn, bread, and butter beans, and there to Carolina.
Yeah. Corn, bread, and butter beans, and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able. Oh, and corn and cotton too, and when the day is over, ride a mule, the crazy fool, and love getting all over.
Wearing shoes and drinking booze is going against the Bible. A necktie will make you die and cause you lots of trouble. Streetcars and whiskey bars and kissing pretty women. Oh man, that's the end of a terrible beginning.
Corn, bread, and butter beans, and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able. Oh, and corn and cotton too, and when the day is over, ride a mule, a crazy fool, and love getting all over.
Can't read and don't care, and education's awful. Raising heck and writing checks, that ought to be unlawful. Silk holes and pretty clothes are just a waste of money. I can see how glad you'll be to marry me, my honey.
Corn, bread, and butter beans, and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able. Oh, and corn and cotton too, and when the day is over, ride a mule, a crazy fool, and love getting all over.
Thanks for joining us for this episode about Appalachian food deserts. We hope you're glad that we pulled it out to share from the Inside Appalachia archives. This show first aired in July of 2015.